it's no surprise that all the world's leaders, all these amazing people, the one common thing that they have is they all read.
Hi everyone, this is Josephine Elia. In this reading interview series, I chat with bookworms, avid readers, and learners to unpack their reading habits and philosophy. My first guest is Justin Kim, a public speaker who has spoken to youth and young adults around the world and a minister for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. He works for several publications. You can check them out in his bio in the show notes. Justin is also a friend, but even though we've been friends for a while, I never asked about his reading habits before. So in these conversations, we talked about how he digests books, how he uses audiobooks, reading in first and second languages, parenting and reading, reading for students and graduate students, how he finds time to read, using emotion as a tool for learning, and much, much more. I enjoyed it tremendously, and I hope you will too. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Justin Kim. Today, I'm talking with Justin Kim to geek out about books and reading and all that things. Yeah, so Justin Kim is a good friend of mine. I've known him for a few years, and we share the love of books. I know he has so many books at home, and he's also a self-learner. So today, we're just having a conversation, basically, to tease out what he does at home, you know, when he's preparing for public speaking or servants, etc., get to know a little bit of his inner life, so to speak. So I will start by asking Justin to explain a little bit. Can you explain, for the sake of people listening, what your role is currently?
In life, I am a son and a husband and a father. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's what you're asking. You're asking about my work, yeah?
Yes.
I am the Assistant Director for Sabbath School and Personal Ministries for the General Conference World Headquarters of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. That's a long title. I work for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm an ordained minister. But just recently, I got called to the World Headquarters to be an editor. And the Adventist Church, as some of you might know, we have something called Sabbath School, which is kind of the equivalent to Sunday School for Adventists. And we meet Saturday mornings, and we have a little Bible study. And one unique aspect about the Adventist Church is everyone in the whole world studies the same topic every Saturday morning. And so I'm part of that department that sets that agenda for the World Church. We have different divisions for, kindergartners, beginners, primaries, all different age cohorts and groups. And so my area of specialty is for college students. And young adults. And so I get to develop little Bible studies or different studies for small groups for young adults to study. To either study the Bible or to study how theology interacts with the real world and some of those dynamics.
So you're determining the topics and the writers for these publications, or?
Yeah. We're in the middle of transition right now, and but right now, as the publication is called the Collegiate Quarterly, and we study the same topic as the adults do, and it's the same topic as around the world. And the writers are actually young adults around the world who send in their contributions, and my job is to edit that and then to compile that together into something studyable and something. Readable. Those aren't real worlds, but yeah.
I see. So it sounds like it's very cerebral. It's very, I mean, it's all around reading and studying. So that's cool.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very interesting because, you know, we're in kind of in a cusp or I don't know what the right word is, but kind of a paradigm shift. And the paradigm shift has been going on for a very long time, but the church is just kind of getting into it, where from regular books to digital. And so there's different philosophies that are competing. One being like, hey, it's all going digital. Like no one's going to be reading books forever, and it's going to be all on screen. And that was kind of the direction that a lot of organizations, church, religious, and non-religious were going towards. But we're finding that the upcoming millennial generation and the generation after, because they're digital natives, they're finding there's nothing really special with the digital, the ebooks and whatnot. And so when they see a book, for like a real book, it's like, wow, it's a real book. And then it becomes more special. Just like how letters handwritten letters are more special than emails. Mm-hmm. The only thing, the qualifications are the books have to be higher quality. And have to be written, just all, like the physical material has to be higher quality, and the actual writing has to be better quality. Mm. Just because there's so much junk writing out there and so much junk materials out there as well. So it's interesting trends that you're seeing in the church and the society.
That's interesting. You actually see these responses when you meet with them.
Oh yeah. So that they feel like it's like, I think for one generation, like if something's on their phone, it's like, wow, it's now my phone, it's on, we have an app, it's awesome. But for another generation, it's like, it's a given, it should already be on the phone. Mm-hmm. And then the fact now, like I think with the emergence of moleskins and journals and then moleskin copies, because the people can't afford the real moleskins and the cheaper versions, like people, like it's a more of a melancholic, meditative experience to write stuff out with your hand. Mm. And so it's not a reaction or whatnot. We're actually finding that both mediums work well together. Mm-hmm. It's both handwritten and digital, and that's kind of the sweet spot between there.
That's awesome. Personally have gone back to long handwriting. Mm. And I found that very therapeutic. And also kind of, it flows better. I don't know. I write better when I'm doing longhand. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. All right. So we're going to talk about books and our love for books.
Yeah.
I thought I'd begin with the beginning.
Okay.
How did you start loving to read? How did that all start for you?
Yeah, this is just very, very weird that we're doing an interview on reading because... Mm-hmm. So I think on one end, I really, really, really hated reading. I did not like reading. I was a latchkey kid. I grew up by myself. I loved TV. So I watched TV. Mm-hmm. And I think with doing this interview, I think everyone's thinking like, wow, he must read a lot and he likes books. But still to this day, there is a little bit of a tension. Like, don't like reading that much, you know, but I do love reading. Don't get me wrong. Please. This interview is going to continue. I do love reading. But there is always like, oh, we gotta sit down and read. And I think I always had that since I was little. I think I developed the love of reading when there was a bookshop that opened up in front of our house. And my parents, they went to some like how to get your kids to go to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton kind of seminars that all Asian parents go to. And then the number one thing that the lecture person says, like, man, your kids need to read. And reading is the single habit that can predict success in your child. And I think I was like, what, third grade, fourth grade, second grade. And so they took me to the bookstore and they're like, hey, we don't care what you read, but just buy something. And I got into a lot of just dumb books. You know, there's a lot of dumb books out there. And then I got into like really good books. And then I got into like dumb good books. And then that's when I developed love reading. And I think what hooked me was series. I think series still hook me. Like, there's one aspect of me that wants to collect the whole series, volume 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and make it look good on your bookshelf.
I totally get that.
And then when you have the whole set, then you're like, now I can read it because I don't have the anxiety of having to collect number 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So I was really into Boxcar Children as a young child, Nancy Drew, Encyclopedia Brown, the Narnia series, and the Anne of Avonlea, Anne of Green Gables series. I know, but it's good stuff. just everything with series, it was just really good. And so that really hooked me into reading a lot.
Mm. So your parents were supportive, it seemed like, or they initiated it.
I think they initiated it. They did buy me the Encyclopedia Britannica when I was really young. And that's actually one series that I always enjoyed. I would just read Encyclopedia all day.
Really?
Yeah. Now you sparked a memory there. Yeah. So that was that. And then I was watching TV and reading the Encyclopedia Britannica. For those of you who don't know what the Encyclopedia Britannica is, that's a,
yeah,
it's a series a long time ago where, you know, it's like Wikipedia, but a lot shorter. And it was like 28 volumes in super nice leather, super big books, and everything that you could want to read about was in there. And so it was very expensive at the time. Now it has zero worth, zero value.
Now you transitioned that love to Wikipedia, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I can spend hours on Wikipedia, which is a really bad thing. just reading random thing from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm. So how did the stuff you read change as you grew up, you know, transition to high school or college or post-college? Did you see the difference transitioning between different genres, the types of books you picked up?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I was a straight A kid, straight A's. I think the only B that I got was in reading a couple years because I just hated reading so much. When I went to high school, it was really cool because I had a really good high school English teacher, and she really got me into looking at literature, not for the story value, but for the deeper meaning. So it's always a good high school teacher that does that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in college, I think I really hated all the reading I had to do there, but I developed some of the habits to read. And then what happened is I actually learned to write in college, which is actually a bad thing. You should learn to read back in high school. But the more you write, it actually feeds your reading. And the more reading you do, it feeds into your writing. And so it's a two-way cycle. And it was really healthy for me. I learned to analyze literature on a deeper level, which got me into more higher, you know, philosophy and theology rather than just narrative stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just, you know, I think it was I was a late bloomer, I guess. And then after college, I just loved reading, period, just to get anything to get my hand on.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't this introverted kid I guess I was introverted, but I wasn't a bookworm as a young kid, but mm-hmm. I developed later on that way.
How do you have an example of how in college, how that reading habit got developed and that relationship with writing and reading?
Yeah. So there's like the spiritual end and there's like the non-spiritual end. Mm-hmm. On the spiritual end, I really got into the Conflict of the Age series by Ellen White, another series, you know, I had to collect the whole series. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I wanted to collect all the Spirit of Prophecy books. That's like the whole, all the books that she wrote. That's what they're called. And then I realized there's like a billion version of volumes of them. So I just kind of gave up collecting them. But because I had so many, I would get reading into it. I would read the books. And then, you know, her chapters are very long and her sentence structure is complex. And her vocabulary is not, you know, 20th century normal vernacular. But so that really, you know, sparked a lot of neurons and just really inspired me to write. And my early writings actually sounded a lot like her. So that was going on. On the flip side, on the secular side, I was taking all these like literature classes. I remember taking Asian American literature to get in touch with my Asian side. And it was just really weird because of the narrative would be like, you know, this guy went into a cave and then the professor said, hey, this cave is a symbol for some da 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 da. Everything was oriented back to sex, which is really, really weird. But which got me thinking like, hey, maybe there are these themes. And that's the first time where I cracked into themes. Maybe these motifs that you find. And then from these motifs, you got into like art. There's motifs in art and then in music and then even in film. And like, wow, there's motifs. And these motifs going out are now also within like would go throughout philosophical ages. And then there's like the postmodern movement that goes anti-motif. And it just got super complex and super philosophical. It got super exciting, you know. So that really was the beginning of trying to analyze reading and seeing what. You know, you have the superficial, and then you have what the author is trying to do, and then you have the third level of the environment that the author is writing and responding to in the midst of this this history of literature and philosophy. And that was just got me excited. And then that fed into my spiritual, and the spiritual fed into my non-spiritual, and the two were very intimately fed into each other.
That's fascinating. It's like a key that got unlocked or a door that got unlocked.
Yeah. 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 The one book that I would highly recommend is called How to Read a Book by Mortimer J. Adler. It just sounds like a dumb book, How to Read a Book. But Mortimer J. Adler was the guy. He was crucial with the Encyclopedia Britannica. He was one of the editors or founder or something like that. But he just realized, like, hey, there's a lot of people out there who don't really know how to read a book. And when I read that, I think it was an assignment for me, and it blew my brains off, like exploded of brains on like on the wall. And it's just very practical. You don't have to read the whole book. And then cool, there's these cool little secrets there. Like, you don't have to read a book, which is really cool because you don't have to read it. You don't have to finish his book. Just really developed the discipline and the skill set to read a book.
Yeah, I actually, that was one thing that I wanted to talk about, you know, geek out about this, how to read a book, because I know you like that. And I've only read that book earlier this year.
Mm.
So I'm in my 30s, or mm-hmm. I'm 30 now. And mm-hmm. that is one book that I know, if I had read that book 15 years earlier, my life would have been better. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact. You know, there's not none of this, because I didn't read that book, I'm here where I am today. And all that, no, out of the window. I know for a fact I would have been so much better off if I had read that book in high school mm-hmm. or even before, you know. So mm-hmm. did you read that book in college or high school?
I read that book in college.
In college. So it was assigned to you in college.
I think it was assigned to me in high school, but I never read it. And I think it was reassigned to me back in college, and I had the book with me. Yeah.
This is one book, and I'm going to take a pause a little bit to say to everyone who's listening, if you're in high school, college, in school, whatever stage, even after, this is one book that you should pick up, How to Read a Book by Mortimer Adler. It's an old classic. It teaches you how to read, which they often don't teach anymore in school. And there's more than just one way of reading from cover to cover, but it tells you how to kind of break down and extract the skeleton of the book and the ideas. Mm-hmm. My favorite part is how to skim a book. Mm-hmm. It goes into how to skim a book, right? And knowing how to, you know, break down a textbook or something really cerebral and, you know, get a first pass of the key thought, so that when the time comes, when you read the book, then you kind of retain more information. You remember more things because you're already somewhat familiar with the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my two cents. Anyone who's listening, pick up How to Read a Book. Very important.
Mm. You know, like I think the habits that were instilled to me by my parents were, you need to open the book and you need to read from page one to the end of the the last page. And until you do that, you haven't read the book, you know. And it's kind of a, you know, and they're good intentioned parents, they are, but it was almost kind of a legalistic perspective. And I think for narratives, you should, right? But I think for like nonfiction and for higher level reading, you're not really trying to read to finish the book. You're trying to see what the point of the author is. And sometimes they say it in the first chapter, and in the last 10 chapters, they're just kind of supplementing why they're right. And so you don't need to read the last 9 chapters. And when I read that, I was like so freeing. I'm like, hey, I just need to know the main point. And if I don't agree with the main point, I want to read the next 9 chapters to see and try to get him to change my mind or get her to change my mind. But often it's once you get the thesis, game over, you can just skim the rest of the parts. And that was amazing to me. So a lot of the books I haven't finished them from cover to cover, but I think I know that the main gist and the thesis and the contribution that they bring to the table.
Oh, man. Yeah. I only develop kind of that, what he calls syntopical reading, right? You know, where you kind of read across and synthesizing your own ideas. I developed that in grad school, you know, but that was through practice, through actually having had to go through, you know, hundreds of journal papers, and you develop it yourself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if I had known that earlier, it would have helped so much more. Do you read in two languages?
I read in English and I read in Korean to my son. His books in Korean, but I don't know what it's saying exactly. I don't think he knows what it's saying.
I was asking just curious if was English your first language or second language?
Oh, you know, that's interesting. It wasn't. Korean was my first language. Mm-hmm. When I went to kindergarten, they put me in ESL. I think I was in ESL for about a week or two. And then afterwards, they're like, yeah, he doesn't need to be in ESL anymore. And, you know, when kids are young, they just pick up languages like, mm-hmm. like candy off the floor. So, yeah, no, it wasn't my first language.
So, but your reading experience is mostly in English. Do you have kind of experiences with reading in Korean or not?
You know, I try to read some spiritual literature in Korean, and I probably can understand maybe 60-70% of it, which when it comes to spiritual literature, that doesn't really help you very much. And then I did study Spanish in college, and was at a point where I'm totally not now, but analyzing poetry and prose in higher level Spanish literature and enjoying it. But now I can just communicate basic Spanish.
Yeah, I was curious. I wasn't sure. I don't remember whether you kind of learned or you spoke Korean first or English first. But I noticed, you know, I read mostly in English now, but mm-hmm. my first readings were in Indonesian, obviously, mm-hmm. English my second language. And mm-hmm. there's a difference, or at least right now, when I pick an Indonesian book, it's just a little different experience, you know, because I'm now reading my mm-hmm. my mother tongue. There's a different experience in the whole, mm-hmm. in the reading, you know, sometimes it feels a little bit like coming home. I can read mm-hmm. faster. I thought, you know, English is, I'm relatively proficient now, but mm-hmm. there's still some straining. I still have to mm-hmm. think more when it's in English mm-hmm. rather than my mm-hmm. yeah, first language. So I was just curious if you had the same thing.
Yeah, I know it's probably not, it doesn't have to do with reading, but like your mother tongue, really, it has almost kind of primordial connection to your emotions. And so for me, not reading, but communicating or listening to something Korean has much more of a powerful emotive force over me. Whereas English is just totally cerebral. It's functional, pragmatic. It's the language I think in. It's the language that I write in. But it's a lot more up here, and I need to intentionally tap into my emotions with English. Whereas for Korean, it's just right. there.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I totally resonate with that. You know, there's also different languages have different musicalities to it, right? Mm-hmm. Different rhythms mm-hmm. and I think when you're not really like cerebrally processing the words, then you kind of feel more of the poetry. In the language,
yeah.
and
yeah.
not just
no,
thinking,
for
like,
sure.
am I getting this right? So, okay, cool.
For sure.
These are something that a lot of people wanted me to ask you. What are the types of books you read now? Favorite titles, you know, topics, things you pick up?
Yeah. What do I read now? I read a lot of random stuff. I love random stuff. I'm a mm-hmm. random person. I just try to read good stuff. After being married and having kids, your time is limited. Mm-hmm. And so I try to either read the stuff that I have to read or stuff to read that I want to read. So, you know, I do go around and give these seminars on how to improve, you know, for college students, how to improve their studying habits and whatnot. But one thing to really improve the mind and the mind life is I always advocate reading seven types of books, sometimes simultaneously, like if you have a low attention span, or one at a time. But and I don't know if you want me to go through all seven, but
sure.
One is just to I choose a book that's really really hard, and the difficulty is not based on vocabulary or in concept. It's just any of the above in an area where I want to grow in. And so sometimes I'll read literature from like the 16th century just because it's language that I'm not really familiar with and it's a struggle to read, but I'll get through it. Or I'll read constitutional law. And I don't know, we have a mutual friend, Amy Shepherd Rotsara, and I try to read through that. And I have no idea what it's saying, but it does stretch my mind. So it's a good thing. Then I try to read something that I enjoy. Second type, the third type of book is a biography that I always try to keep it keeps my feet on the ground and keeps me real. The fourth type book is what is the fourth type of book? Oh, just a random book. Totally random book. The fifth type is a book that I want to specialize in, and usually I try to read 5 to 10 books of the same topic, so become a specialist in it. The sixth book is a spiritual book, and the seventh is the Bible. So those are kind of the seven books that you rotate around. And then so if someone is like, hey, it says 7 days in a week, and sometimes should you read one book at a time, one day of the week? And I'm like, I don't recommend that, because then you just become super confused. But I just read one book until I get bored of it, and I switch to another.
Mm. What's on your book stand or on your nightstand? What books are you reading right now? At this moment?
Right now, I'm reading, there's so many books on my bookstand right now. I'm reading Lincoln, a biography by Abraham Lincoln. And a second book I'm reading is Ingrained, one of the two, by Skip McCarty, on the covenants. There's another book, and my desk is over there, so I don't, I'm reading The Big Five by Joe Kidder. And then I'm reading also My Almost for His Highest by Oswald Chambers. Mm. That's probably the books that I remember for now.
Cool. How do you find titles? Do you go on Amazon to browse for titles, or where do you get?
Yeah, you know, I have like no problem finding books that I want to read. it's the opposite that I need to develop of trying not to buy these books. Going on Amazon is very dangerous, because I end up buying all of Amazon, and it's not good.
Where do you find the title? Like, how do you find those things that you want to read?
That's a good question. I don't know. Okay. So I'll just talk out loud what I'm thinking, maybe something that will click. I do subscribe to a magazine called Books and Culture that's developed by Christianity Today. And these are kind of like it's scholarly, academic. It's like a newspaper, and they all come up with reviews of the latest theology books. And then they do a lot of prose there, a lot of analysis. And I read through that, and I'm like, man, I want to read this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And then I'll go on Amazon. And once you're on Amazon, you can never get out, because you're going, oh, there's this and this. Oh, there's this. And da, 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 da. I visit a lot of bookstores for fun, used bookstores. I don't know. I just do a lot of online surfing. A lot of the authors that I like, usually they will publish more books, and then I have to pay them for those books and then become broke because I'm addicted to their stuff. It's kind of, I have the opposite problem. My wife is trying to tell me to read the books that I buy and then buy another one. But my thing is, like, I need to buy it now, because I don't know if I can find it later, and it might be more expensive later. I don't know. And so we have these interesting marriage plays a factor into reading. I'm reading a lot of marriage books too, just to become a better husband, a better dad, life stuff too. So
do you read on the Kindle?
Yes and no. I got a Kindle a couple of years ago. Somebody gave it to me as a gift. And I love it, because the books are a lot cheaper, and you can get it instantaneously. But to be honest, I don't remember any book that I read on Kindle, which is really, really weird. The fact that I can't interact with text. And I know you can. There's these, you know, these gymnastics to get around that, but I don't like it. Probably the only book that I remember reading is Bonhoeffer, just because it was like a billion pages long, and it took me like 9 years to get through it. And so I remember the tedium of the Kindle because of it. So I don't use it now. It's great to travel with, but I think for retention's sake, and I think I read somewhere that retention wise, it's not as good. So it just, call me old fashioned, but it's here, and I do use it for some stuff, but it's not my main driver for readers.
Yeah. I'm similar. I remember more with paper, right? Because
yeah.
It's the tactile memory. You know, I remember where things are based on touch. You know,
totally.
I know how it feels. And I think I read somewhere too, you know, just having that displayed on the bookshelves helps your mental memory, mental map too, right? Because you kind of remember, oh, when you see it, you remember, right? Otherwise, in the Kindle, out of sight, out of mind, you don't remember as much. So.
And the other thing is, like, I don't know about you, but, like, spatially, like, the fact that I've ended a chapter and then there's a new chapter and then chapter five is on the right-hand side, you know, or heading up is on the left-hand side. Like, I feel like I've gained somewhere.
Yeah.
And I know you have that status bar on the bottom, but that's not very satisfying. And then when you mess with the fonts, then, like, then you don't know where you are. It's just, like, it's just open text, you know, this amorphous text that you're reading. So it's just the paper. I think
so
it's
your
more...
You're a paper guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about audiobooks?
I am a huge audiobook person. Huge audiobook. I just finished Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath, and I subscribe to an audiobook club that I get, you know, free audiobooks once a month.
What is
it? If you guys go to Christian, I think it's christianaudio.com, and you can get, like, they actually, I mean, I got Brothers Karamazov for free. I mean, and it was, like, super high quality, super long, and you can get that for free. And they have these, you know, I got Diary of Anne Frank. And these are books that I don't think I would have probably read, but because, you know, my commute and the traffic, I love traffic now. You know, the only battle is, should I listen to NPR? Should I listen to a sermon? Should I listen to my audiobook? That's kind of the conundrum that I have. But I think it's just a beautiful use of time. And I don't know, my retention is pretty good. The only thing for me is the author has to read the book. It can't be some other. I mean, it's going to be hard for Dostoevsky to read his book because he's not around. But for, like, Malcolm Gladwell, like, the inflections and the points he's trying to make just make it more powerful.
I love it when the author is the one narrating the book, or at least or at least the sound in my mind sounds like the author. in the picture.
Yeah, it sounds like Dostoevsky. Okay. Got a Russian accent.
My first audiobook was Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. I don't know if you've read that book, but it's it's an attorney, you know, advocating for people on death row. So it was it was a very powerful book, you know, just by it is, but he was the one narrating the story, so it was incredibly impactful. I love that. Some audiobooks I'm not really crazy for. For example, like, things that are really kind of, it reads like a thesis. That one I have a hard time keeping up. When it's stories, then, you know, it's more natural.
The narratives are just easier to remember. And I think it goes back to, like, Greek and maybe even, like, you know, Hebrew way of thinking. You know, Hebrew is a lot more narrative, and it's just easier to understand or to memorize for some people. But for other people, for it to be organized, you need to be Greek. You need to have your thesis and then some point A and then, you know, da da da, some point B, some point. It's a lot more clinical and sterile, and it's just.
Yeah.
It is more organized, but it doesn't make it necessarily easier to remember in the end. It's just maybe different styles of thinking.
Right. And, I mean, with narratives, too, your emotions get involved, right? And so remember
true,
more.
True.
Okay. People ask for the logistics. How many books do you read, like, per month?
Yeah, that's a super good question. I don't know. I can't really give you an answer just because I don't finish all the books that I read. So I don't know if I consider them to be read, but I pretty much consider them to have been conquered. So
how many books do you conquer?
It's depending if I do a project, but I think I average about maybe 4 or 5 a month, you know, and sometimes more and sometimes a lot less.
Depending on the length, of course, right?
Yeah. And so it's never, I don't think I've had a consistent month. Yeah, and then there's some books that you just use, you're reading, like, you're reading all year, and then when you're done, you don't remember what you read, so you keep on reading it, and you just, this never-ending story. And there's others that probably I read in a day just because, you know, it's more of a reference book, and so I'll try to get the points that I want out of it, and so I'm not really reading it. But so yeah, I'm more pragmatic. I think if the majority of the books that I had were more narrative in nature, that would be a different story, you know.
How do you remember what you read? What's your process? You know, when you crack open a book, whatever, for learning, for information, how do you actually read, and how do you retain that information?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I don't know the right answer to that. And I think just like with anybody else, I always forget. You know, I'll be going through my library. I'm like, man, that sounds like a good book. And I'll open it. I'm like, man, I already read this. This is a figure. So I think two things that really help me is one is to attribute emotive value to it. And so what I do is while I'm reading it, I need to muster up. Sometimes when it's so dry, it's hard to, but you try to muster up emotions to it, you know? And so, I'm a total believer in marking up books. I don't believe you should mark it up so much that the next person can't read it. I think that's defeats the purpose of having a book, but, you know, like having a smiley face or an exclamation mark or a highlighter, like you totally agree with this, man. This is like, this person is inspired. This is so awesome. Like, you know, you want to rip it out and put it on and put in a fortune cookie and distribute it to every person in the world. Like you want to have so much excitement to it. Or you have like, you get so angry. Like this guy is like so vulgar. Like how could he articulate this in 2016? And you have like disgust or contempt for this writer. And you put those emotions to it. And what happens is, without you even trying to memorize, you it's pretty much in your brain. I think emotions sear the information into your brain. So I try to do that. That's one tactic. The second tactic is, I think, as a benefit of being married, you always have to share what you've learned. So my wife is the unfortunate victim of like, hey honey, like hey, did you know, like da 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 da. And it's only like 6:30 in the morning, and she's like, "Huh, were you reading again?" I'm like, "Uh-huh." And but the cool thing is, because I've shared it, it becomes a part of me, you know. And what happens is, subconsciously, I end up sharing it like 9 years later in some weird conversation, and I don't even remember where it came from, but it's a part of me. So those are the two things. I think me being a minister or a public speaker also helps, because I'm always sharing something. I think that's where a random book always helps, because this random information ends up being not so random later on.
Right.
And you'd be surprised how much the brain really retains.
Yeah. It goes back to what that book, right? How to Read a Book talks to, because he talks about reading actively and not being a passive reader. Mm. So you're having a conversation mm-hmm. with the author, mark up, you know, the margins, just... That also totally. Gave me the license to destroy the book. Like, I used to be really protective of my books. I want to keep it in pristine condition and make it look, keep it all pretty and stuff. But, you know, this just gives me the license. The reason you have a book is because you want to insert that into your mind. So now I destroy my books. So do you lend your books? Do you let people borrow your books? Are you possessive?
I jealously guard my library. I don't like lending it out to even my friends. The only reason why is like, you know, I know I have a lot of books, and I know what I have. I know where they are. I have a specific place for them. And so like, just with my, when I do a lot of reading or researching, I need like when the idea or random idea pops up, I need quick access to that book right at that time. But it's happened to me in the past. It actually happened to me 5 times where, you know, like, yeah, I need that book. I'm like, it's not here. Where is it? So I'll be searching my entire library. I'm like, oh, yeah, I lent it to somebody. And I think, you know, without outing some of my friends, I think like almost 95% of them, you know, the books I lend, I never get back, you know. Or if I get back, they're in, you know, a condition of which I need to be more sanctified in replying to, you know. But it's, and I realize, you know, books are books, you know, and so whatnot. So just as a policy, if one could have a policy for their own personal library. I just don't like to lend them out, which, you know, I've had some other friends, some friends that we mutually share, would get kind of mad about. It's like, are we not friends? Why won't you share? Lend me this book. I'm like, well, I'd rather give you the money for you to buy the book and then purchase it on your own.
I'm completely the same way. I'm very possessive. And I'd rather buy them a book, a brand new one, than borrow my copy. Because, you know, like once I've written notes, highlighted, you know, earmark it, then it's mine. Like that book is mine.
Right.
And it has... Oh, certainly it has my thoughts in there, which, you know, depending on the situation, I may not want to share. So my next question is, do you use the library as a resource?
I do use the library. We're huge library people.
Mm-hmm.
My wife uses the library. My son uses the library. I use the library for audiobooks that I want to get that are too expensive for me to buy. And then also for like big books that I probably want to read, but again, they're too expensive, that won't really add to my library. I feel like I need to develop my personal library and sort of like more stuff that's come out recently and I really want to get my hands on, but I don't want to pay, you know, $39.95 for, and then after it's on my shelf, I'm never going to read ever again. Those things I use the library for. And we're fortunate. We just moved to Maryland, and the Howard County Library is like one of the top libraries in the United States. So we're very, very privileged to utilize the resource. Yeah. The other thing is, because it has a due date, it's a great impetus to make me finish the book. You know, like, because I hate the fact there's a contingency hanging over my head. So it really motivates me, like, man, I got to just finish reading this to get rid of this and give it back to the library. Whereas my books, I just read forever and, you know, just
timeline to it. What happens to me if I borrow audiobooks from library? Because, you know, my commute, I only listen to audiobooks during commute, but it's not enough, not enough commute to finish the audiobook. So what ends up happening, and this happens multiple times, the due date is coming, got to return the audiobooks. I end up listening to like twice the speed. Just to get it done.
Yeah, no, that is a given, Josephine. I do that even when I don't have a due date. That's one of the beauties of audiobooks. You can actually digest more and speed it up. But I have to do like 1.5. I don't know how you do 2.0.
Yeah,
2.0 is too fast for me.
I was like really, you know, it was like close to the hour. And seriously, that one book, I just wanted to get it done. I don't know. It's just obsessive. I wanted to get it done before I return it. So it's twice. You know, I calculated, like being a nerd, I calculated the speed, right? How much is left and what's the speed I have to get it done. And I'm like, I have to do it two times to get to make the deadline. So I finished it like a minute before it expired. It's not the best arrangement, but you know,
that's a true calculation. That's a true calculation there.
It's I do that all
no,
the time.
All of my audiobooks are done 1.5.
Uh-huh.
And the negative thing about that is, like, you know, my commute is about 20 minutes on a good day and like an hour and a half on a bad day, depending on traffic.
Uh-huh.
And then so I'll go into the office, and then after like an hour and a half of like 1.5 or 2.0, like the whole day, everyone is speaking so slow. And I'm like, can you like speed it up? Like, can you hurry up? Like, or I'll be finishing their sentences, or I'm like guessing what they're trying to say. And I get so impatient with them.
That's
like,
hilarious.
Sometimes you wish the whole world was on 1.5.
Oh my goodness. That's awesome. How do you arrange your bookshelves at home? Do you have a method? I know you have a lot of shelves. I've seen your shelves. Do you arrange them by topics, or is there a method? You know how you group books together.
I don't know if it's a method, but I can explain what there. I have like kind of four main sections. One is where all my I'm a Seventh-day Adventist minister, so a lot of my books are from the Seventh-day Adventist perspective. So that one whole section is full of the Adventist authors. And then I just arrange it by author from that point on. The second section is all my, the rest of my Christian books, religious books. The third is secular, all my biographies, political, sociological books, pop psychology, sociology books are there. The other section is all my series, John Wesley's writings, great preaching from the last, 200 years. Commentaries, dissertation series, all the series are there. And then, like, in my office, the closest books that I have are, I really revere the Adventist Bible Commentary and the Conflict of the Age series and the Spirit of Prophecy writings. Those are had a seminal influence in my spiritual development. So those are really closest to me. And then there's like another bookshelf, which is near me. And those are where I put like topical stuff. So I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. So the topics that are of interest to me right now are, I have a section on North Korea, another section on, music and the brain, another section on the dialogue between science and religion, another one on postmodernity and emergent movement and youth ministry, another on developing creativity and neurological studies, another one on apologetics. And so these are all like these subsections that I have. And then next in my reading table, I have like on the top shelf, I have all my, I collect Bibles from different languages. So I have about 15 different languages, and those are just there for decorative purposes. I don't read any of them.
This is the series that you collect as well.
Yeah. And then I have just a bunch of books that are there that I just read that I'm trying to get through. So yeah, it's kind of how I organize. How do you organize? Do people have systems? I don't know. Yeah.
I think I'm generally by topics as well.
Okay.
Religious books, entrepreneurship books, humanitarian, mm-hmm. Biographies of humanitarians or political biographies, things like that. I think that's mm-hmm. generally how I do it. I don't alphabetize the author. Do you do that?
Oh, I do. I think the reason I do that because I like to have like the authors together. So I have a lot of books by John Stott, a lot of books by Rabbi Zacharias. I'm looking at my Christian section. A lot of books by C.S. Lewis, a lot of books by Timothy Keller. So they're all kind of together. And then so one day I was kind of bored. I'm like, well, if they're together, well, might as well just organize the rest of the library. I don't know. That wasn't very logical, but that's kind of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved like 3 months ago, so they're still not at home yet. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you read for fun, like for entertainment?
What do I read for entertainment? Like I said before, I like going on Wikipedia. I learn languages for fun. That doesn't mean I'm good at any of the languages, because I'll learn a language until it gets hard, and then I'll switch to another language. So then what happens? I become a jack of all trades, and then a master of none. But my, I was learning German for a while, and I switched to Chinese, and now I'm on this Greek trip right now. For fun, I guess, I gotta admit, like,
guilty pleasures. Someone asked about
guilty
that.
Pleasures. Yeah, that's a good question. I think I read a lot of science, not a lot. I think comparatively, it's not. It's very, 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 very minimal. But a lot of science fiction. And there's a lot of different types of science fiction, and so my mind is very selective. I think my natural interests lie in systematic theology, and so there's a really cool connection between systematic theology and science fiction. So in systematic theology, it's like, so just imagine the world having all these settings, they're like, you have ethics, and you have like the existence of divinity, humanity, morality. You have, purpose, the nature of reality and all these things. And just imagine like messing with these settings, like
hey, let's put this at zero, this one to like nine. And then, so what systematic theology is trying to do is trying to describe current reality as we know it. Science fiction, this is like higher level science, not like, you know, Marvel, you know, Captain America versus Batman, whatever stuff. Like higher level science fiction says, hey, what if we just dial the setting to like, instead of five, let's put it nine. What kind of world would that be? And so just imagining that kind of world, and then the narrative around it, and then see how morality fits. Like, that's just the very, very, very fascinating, entertaining to me. And that helps me kind of a more objective perspective. Not that I am objective, but more objective in experiencing reality and how reality should be.
That is fascinating. Do you have some titles, favorite titles, science fiction books?
So the classic science fiction guy is a guy named Philip K. Dick. He's just the quintessential science fiction guy. A lot of his books have been made into movies and into pop entertainment culture. But there's this underlying, like, and he's trying to intersect into technology and some of these things. So he's a good guy. But even like classic children's books like A Wrinkle in Time, or even C.S. Lewis's Narnia series, or his other series like Out of This Silent Planet and Palandra, like, there are these just cool little experiments to see. It's you know, like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien would do this. Like, it's into world creating, you know, and even pop science fiction does that. Like, comic books would do this, and without geeking out too much into comic books, but they all have these like theological ramifications. There was this like the trend, I think both Marvel and DC Comics were trying to do this, but you know, you have these superheroes of like ultimate power, and the golden question that humanity is trying to solve is, you know, can we trust a higher being with omnipotent power? You know, how do we trust that this power is innately good? I mean, that's a question of theology that we've been trying to answer for like the last 6,000 years. You know, that's a fundamental philosophical question. And these producers and directors of all these current movies of science fiction, I think like Zack Snyder and some of these guys, they admit like a lot of these movies underlying is, can we trust God? Can we trust God? Which, you know, you bring back to Avanist philosophy, Avanist theology is, how can the universe trust God? And the whole reason of salvation and this whole religion thing, it's all coming back to the point is, it's not human beings that are on trial and human beings being judged. It's God being on trial and God being in the judgment. If he's all powerful and if he's all good, then why does evil exist? And he's currently in the witness stand or not the witness stand, he's currently being judged right now. And anyway, it's cool how pop culture is reflecting some of these theological themes.
How do you find time to read?
So I didn't really know how much time I had until I got married. And then after being married, I didn't know how much time I had married until I had my first child. And so now, time management is you know, and I thought I was a pretty good manager of time before, but now it just has to be razor sharp, accurate. Which, you know, you don't want to become so rigid, you know, you lose the organicness with the family, but. So as of late, I've been reading a lot of what popular, productive, famous, successful, powerful people do. And they all seem to go to bed early. And so I've been experimenting with that, and I've been trying to do that. So for a good time, for a while now, I've been going to bed around 9 or 10 and getting up at 5. And I don't know if it's the habit of it or if it's I'm just getting old and I'm learning to get to bed earlier and rising up. But I love getting up at 5, and it's been revolutionizing my devotional time.
and to use my time better in the morning. And then once I do that, then everything kind of clicks into place. So usually, I mean, when it comes to reading, I usually read in the morning and a little bit at night. When I'm feeling I have energy at night, usually I'm so drained by the end of the day, it's a temptation just to kind of be on, go on Facebook and or watch some videos on YouTube and then go to bed afterwards. But I try to develop an endurance to read at night. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I love, I like reading in the morning too, because it's kind of brain mm-hmm. food, you know, to get ready for the day. Sometimes I feel, mm-hmm. I feel like I need a bit more inspiration. So with reading, it helps me getting mm-hmm. my engine on, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted mm-hmm. to ask you, now that you're a parent, right, your son Noah is how old? 2 now?
He's 2 going on 3.
Mm-hmm. And how do you approach parenting and reading? Is reading something you encourage him to do, or, you know, in the future, how do you encourage in that direction, or how do you cultivate curiosity, even if it's not reading, in Noah now?
Yeah, it's a great question. We are just so fortunate that he's a bookworm. He's a total bookworm. And I really attribute it to my wife. She has 2 sisters in Korea, and they're really into, you know, education and educating their kids and getting their kids into reading. And so she single-handedly, I think she either borrowed or negotiated or stole one of the 3 verbs there, almost like a quarter or a third of her nephew's books, and she brought it over to America. And these books are like, they're all series, they're all like narratives, and they're all designed to, you know, develop X, Y, or Z. And so, you know, his library is probably a fourth of the size of my library. It's a very sizable. Yeah, it's huge.
That's impressive.
So since birth, I was impressed that she would just bring this in her luggage with her, and then over on boats and packaged over here. And so ever since birth, like she would do it, and we do it for morning and evening during our devotions, but during the free times throughout the day, you know, she would read to him, and he just developed this love for books. Like, it's his world. And so now at age 2, it's the age where he's really learning concentration skills and focus. And, you know, so we read that if the kids are interested in something, like, let them be. Don't interrupt them. Don't mess with their focus. Help them develop a long-term attention to stuff. So now, like, you know, which you know, when your kids are not, when they're super quiet, like, you freak out. Like, is something wrong? Are they dead? Are they lying in a pool of blood somewhere? Like, you freak out. So we'll go searching for him around the house. And often he's just in the library in his room, and he's just reading. Now, he can't read. He can't read the letters and the words. But because we read to them, like, these billions of books a billion times, that he knows the narrative of all of them. And, you know, we find that his communication skills are far more advanced than others his age. And he's expressing himself. He's got long-term focus abilities. And it's just, it's awesome. It's awesome. So I attribute that quality to the diligence of my wife.
You guys read to him in English and Korean, or mostly Korean?
It's mostly Korean. We'll borrow books from the library, and they'll be, you know, our library is so awesome. They got books in Korean also. But I'll read to him in English, and then she'll read to him in Korean. And so he's not verbally bilingual yet, but he understands both languages a bit, for sure more Korean. And the cool thing is, like, you know, he'll ask me something in Korean. I'm like, I don't know, go ask your mom. So my mom, His mom, my wife, has become the authority in all things Korean. But if something's in English and my wife doesn't ask her dad, so then I become the authority in all things English and American. And he knows how to switch on and switch off when it comes to those things with each parent. It's really cool how to see that.
How about the book selection? Do you have a like a philosophy of selecting the books that you're exposing him to?
Yeah, we generally like books that that teach something. I know this sounds so stupid, but like it's weird. There's just like philosophy that we've seen, whether it's intentional or not, we don't know. But there's like this kind of this motif in children's books that the more pointless they are, the more, you know, the more, I don't know what, purposeless, the more goofy, the more like just random they are, the better for kids. And it develops their imagination. And like we find that it doesn't. It'll just be, it'll be talking about a duck, and then duck is looking for something, and then he runs into a gorilla, and then they go on a boat, and then they go to the moon, and then they count popsicle sticks on Mars. And then it's just like, what's the point of all that? And maybe, you know, maybe we got to read a book on children's education and imagination, but we just find that like narrative books that have a beginning, ending, and a middle, there's a conflict resolution, there's like a moral to it. Like he just really enjoys, and he's looking for those things. Books that, you know, with our current religious and spiritual perspectives, what if they have like spiritual components, spiritualistic components, I should say, like ghosts or magic, or, you know, Halloween-y stuff, we should kind of shy away from for the time being. And, you know, we try to gear him to, for sure, biblical literature for now. But we're not afraid to for other secular things either.
Yeah. You know, obviously I don't have any kids, so I don't know too much about children's books. But, you know, the New York Times has a whole section about children's books that they review. Sometimes I, you know, occasionally I would skim through those, and you know, some of them are really deep. You know, I mean, it's, it's a children's book. It has graphics and stuff, but the message is could be very profound.
Yeah, often the most profound stuff is it's very simple, and it's geared towards children, but it's there's some good stuff out there for kids.
What are your favorite children's books? There seems to be some inside jokes. Someone posted this question for you. Favorite children's books, and there seems to be some inside jokes going on that I don't get.
Yeah, so there, I think me being an only child, I really enjoyed books with where there were a lot of siblings. So I really enjoyed the Narnia series growing up. That was probably my all-time favorite. Because there was the Pevensey children, two boys and two girls. I also enjoyed the Boxcar Children. I think I collected the whole series. Again, two kids, two girls, two boys, two girls. I really enjoyed Curious George growing up. Curious George was, and it's so cool. It's so cool that I can read those same books to my child now. I think everybody loves the Little Prince. How can you not like that story? That's one of those, again, one of those profound books. The other kids' books that come to mind are like The Giving Tree or A Wrinkle in Time, that I really liked growing up. I saw this question on Facebook, and so the others who responded were parents of other kids, parents of their kids, and then they had given us some of these books. And so one of Noah's favorite books was A Little Blue Truck, and that was given to him by Judah Ackenberger, which was one of his favorite books. And there's a sequel to it, and there's a lot of sounds there, onomatopoeia. And he loved it as a little boy. I mean, Noah still is a little boy, but when he was younger, he still is it now. And so, yeah.
What do you want to get better at in reading? Is there something that you're working on, you wish, you want to do better, you want to work on it a bit more?
In terms of reading?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, like, you know, there are these moments where, and I think the key to reading a book is to almost kind of like x-ray it and kind of see it, you know. No, I think it's just key. Like, any person who picks up a book, the first thing they should do is to look at the table of contents and to see what's the flow of the book, you know, what is it trying to do, how is it organized, and then to kind of get the thesis, the main point, you know, like, what is this book trying to do? What is it trying to convince me of? How can I utilize this book? How can I just master this book, and how can I make it part of me? And so that's my objective every single time I pick up a book. And so some books, like, I'll just read, and I don't even have to finish some of them. Sometimes I do, but I feel like I've x-rayed, I've mastered it. It's become a part of me, like, and I've digested it. And there's other books, and I'll read, and, you know, I can't do that. And it may be because of my reading comprehension skills, or I don't know, I just need to develop more. But that's one skill that I really want to hone in, because I think, especially those in graduate studies and doctoral studies, the amount of reading that need to be done, this is one skill that really helped, that you just kind of in a very short amount of time, x-ray the book, boom, you're done. You can just move on to something else rather than muddle your way through each page.
Yeah, absolutely. I would have gained a lot more if I knew that, you know, beforehand. What books would you give to a younger you? And you can pick an age.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably maybe give Steps to Christ to me at a younger age. I wasn't introduced to the writings of Ellen White until my late teens. I didn't really even know who she was, even though I was a Seventh-day Adventist the whole time. So that's probably for spiritual development. I always had the Bible, and I always enjoyed reading the Bible. Probably some books that had a profound impact upon me was one book called Letters to a Young Poet by Rainer Maria Rilke. It was a short book, very easy to read. I probably would have introduced myself to that at a younger age, in my high school years. That's probably the only two books that come to mind right now. That's a good question.
One last thing. Why should people read? It's a simple question, but, you know, what would be your campaign? What would be your reasons why people should read?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. You know, I think there's something magical, magically profound about reading. It's you know, and again, you're coming from a spiritual perspective. Of all the mediums out there, from film to music to whatnot, to the visual, to the culinary, whatever. Through all the media out there, like, God chose the medium of writing, to communicate these deep truths, and I think that's just profound. That keeps me thinking, and that medium was, you know, and some people say, well, he was trying to accommodate to the primitive times back then, and they only had writing and whatnot. And, you know, if he were to communicate the Bible today, he would use the video or YouTube video. And I think I would disagree, you know, like, there's something about the medium that he chose. And there's something about writing that it just has a profound impact upon your thinking. There's something about text connecting with the hand to, you know, your fingers, to your eyes, and the time that you spend, and it's the only way for your mind, for yourself to grow. And so we're living in this age of, like, content creation, you know, like, we always want to be a content creator. We don't want to like and just, you know, keep forwarding and passing stuff on. We want original content. And there's something about writing
And there's something about reading especially. And those two things are intimately connected, but I think it starts with reading that makes you, you know, you're reading the original content of somebody else. And then through the process of digesting a variety of material, you come up with your own stuff. And it's no surprise that all the world's leaders, all these amazing people, the one common thing that they have is they all read. And it doesn't mean that you agree with everything that you read, but just getting into that discipline has this almost kind of, you know, divine component to you. And I just think that's for anyone out there who, you know, and I don't think we got to move aside our digital media in this day. I mean, if you do, that's even better. But to kind of sit down and to kind of get back to the old discipline of reading, it will not be easy in the beginning. Again, it's a discipline, but once developed, and for me, it's still developing. It just has profound, profound repercussions in one's individual life.
Well, Justin, this has been a really fun and fascinating conversation. If people want to find you, where can they find you in the World Wide Web?
Or oh, online.
Do you want to be found?
You want me to give my address? I'm going to give my address.
No. Online.
Oh, you guys are welcome to come over. I have a Twitter account and a Facebook. And I think you can also visit my blog at beforethink.org. And just a handful of my editorials and writings are there. That's where I am digitally.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Joe. This is fun.
If you like what you heard, share it with your friends. Share it on social media, wherever things are shared these days. Also, let me know who else you'd like to hear from. Other guests I should ask similar questions to. If you don't want to miss any future episode, sign up for my newsletter at josephineelia.com. That's josephineelia.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay smart.